the Fields Institute for hosting us for this program, and thanks all for coming. I need to apologize for the fact that I'm not feeling very well, so we might take it very gently and perhaps have a break in the middle, and everyone's welcome to join in and contribute if I seem to be somehow waxing and waning. So this is all about N categories with duals and TQFD. I'm not entirely sure what the level of knowledge of everybody in this room is, so please do stop to ask me things if you need to as we go along. My aim is to be very introductory about this, so I'm sure there are many people in the room who will already know a lot of what I'm going to say. So what's the starting point for this? Well, one possible way of looking at it is this. There are many definitions of N category that have been proposed, but there aren't very many examples of N categories, except in some degenerate or trivial cases. For example, of course, every category is a form of N category, or cases where everything is invertible, which is much easier. So it's a situation that's much easier to understand than the general N category situation, or situations where everything is invertible above dimension 1, for example. That's also much easier to understand. But in the case of, for actual just general N categories, there haven't been very many examples that have been constructed. And this is perhaps a problem. And for many people, it's something that they want to see. Okay, it's all very well, there's all this theory, but what does this theory do? Where are the examples? And in fact, there are some motivating examples. And the example that arises from TQFD was certainly one of the motivating examples for some authors, particularly Byers and Dolan, for example. But it still hasn't been entirely worked out. And so the purpose of this mini course, as I see it, is to introduce the questions and give the motivation for why this should form an N category and why it's a particularly interesting form of N category to study, what sort of structure we should be looking for on it, and then to look at what has been done, what has been constructed for low dimensions. Some of the low dimensions have been constructed by Byers and Langford in HDA4, and before that by Mei-Chi Shum in her thesis about categories of tangles and tautile tensor categories, and coherence for tautile tensor categories, in which these tangle diagrams arose, although she wasn't explicitly thinking about TQFD or anything like that. So those are some low dimensions which have been worked out. That's what we'll probably do tomorrow. And then on Thursday, I'd like to look at some attempts to construct the general n-dimensional case, starting with a definition of Todd Trimble, which looks like it's going to be very useful for, it looks like it is a very natural thing that we could use to define the n-categorical structure on these things. And then an attempt at a definition by myself and Nick Gursky, where we tried to actually do it and use this thing, and it turned out to be not quite as straightforward as one might have hoped for various reasons. And then finally, on Friday, I'd like to talk a bit about what happens if we drop the N, because in N categories, the whole point is you carry on going up till N, and then you decide you've had enough, and you're going to quotient everything out and stop. But what happens if you don't bother doing that, and you decide you're going to keep going forever and go to omega? And in a way, this sounds like it's much more difficult. But on Friday, we'll talk about some ways in which, in fact, it becomes much easier, because it's like procrastinating forever. You procrastinate all your problems forever, and you never actually have to deal with them. Because what happens when you do N is you have to stop at N and make everything tie up neatly and be coherent at N. But if you just decide you're never going to do that, some slightly surprising things can happen. So we'll look at that on Friday. So that's the general idea of how this is going to go. So the whole of today is going to be kind of introductory, and what I'd like to talk about most of all is the three hypotheses that Byers and Dolan propose in their paper on higher dimensional algebra. Bless you. it's not just me sneezing, that's alarming, in their paper High Dimensional Algebra and Topological Quantum Field Theory, which is an extremely rich paper which is very full of ideas and propositions for the future, most of which are still not being worked out yet. So I think I never quite finished saying what the overall aim of this course is. And overall, what I'd most like to do is emphasize the questions that remain open and that I think it would be interesting and important to have answered, in the hope that people might become interested in trying to answer some of these questions. So some of us have seen various beautiful talks, such as Aaron, that talked about TQFT and cobordisms in some low dimensions. So first of all, I'm going to just introduce the sorts of things we're talking about and draw some pictures so that we all have some pictures in our head. So a cobordism, it's all about things between manifolds, right? So if you have some N manifolds, and we'll start by thinking of N manifolds without boundary. Here is a nice N manifold that is in fact a 1 manifold, and if John were here, he would probably say, tell us what it's really called. Of course, it's a circle. And we can talk about them being cobordant if there's, here's a manifold, and here's another manifold. If there's a manifold with those things as its boundary, so you can call this a cobordism between these manifolds. And these things form a category in a sort of pictorially obvious way, where if you took another one, you could stick it on the end here. Here's a perfectly good 1 manifold, which happens to be 3 circles, and here's a perfectly good manifold in between them. And so we could stick these two things together and get a manifold that looks like this. It's got 2 circles at the top and it's got 3 at the bottom. And it's got a couple of holes in it. So that's a sort of composition. So naively, we're already seeing why we might expect this to form a category. More than that, we might expect it to form a monoidal category, because we can just put these things side by side and that's some kind of tensor product. We expect a monoidal structure by disjoint union. So we can take 2 circles and we can, as it were, tensor them with another circle and we get 3 of them. And if we take some manifold in between them and something else over here, I mean, this is just, nothing happens, right? So the tensor of these two things is just literally the thing that it is. I'm quite sure why I'm even drawing this other picture here, but here we are. And this gives us some pictures that we may or may not be quite used to seeing as related to two-dimensional TQFT. Now, topological quantum field theory was originally defined as a bunch of data satisfying a bunch of axioms. But there's a nice way of restating it, which Aaron's already told us about, which, if you like categories, then you like this definition because it expresses it all in terms of category theory and it makes the definition very concise. So, an n-dimensional TQFT is some data satisfying some axioms, but this can all be encapsulated in the following categorical definition. Metric monoidal functor from this symmetric monoidal category. I didn't really say anything about the symmetry, but to the symmetric monoidal category of vector spaces. This tensor product isn't very interesting, and when tensor products aren't very interesting, they tend to be symmetric. So that sounds a bit facetious, but all I've done is stick them side by side, and if I had stuck them side by side the other way around, there would be a way of getting from one way around to the other way around in a not very interesting way. So one of the things that's important to remember, which I feel like I'm about to forget already, and perhaps Aaron is going to remind me where I am, is what n this is referring to. Because I think it's not referring to the object.
Yeah,
usually, right.
N minus one.
So this is really so what I've drawn here is 2 cob. So this is really n minus one manifolds. So it's one of those confusing things that sometimes we name a category after its object and sometimes we name it after its morphisms. And in this case, we happen to have named it after its morphisms. And this problem is going to get worse and worse, because when we're considering it as an N category, we're going to keep naming it after its N cells rather than its zero cells. So this is a kind of abstract formulation of what used to be a page full of data and axioms. And, of course, sometimes the data and axioms are more useful, and sometimes the abstract definition is more useful. But one of the things that abstract definitions tend to be more useful for is generalization. And since we're interested in generalizing this, this is the kind of thing we're going to look at. So you might say to yourself, well, this is all very well. Why are we ever going to need to talk about N categories? Because all we've got here is some objects and some morphisms. Why are there any more dimensions? Well, this question of N categories arises when you start thinking about extended TQSDs or N cobordisms with corners. Example here, it was more simple because our objects were manifolds that weren't allowed to have any boundary, and only our morphisms were allowed to have any boundary in between them. But if we allowed some boundary on our object, then everything would become more complicated. So here we could kind of ignore the question of zero manifolds, because there weren't really any that were doing anything interesting. But if we allowed our one manifolds to have some boundary, then we would have to record the zero manifolds that were their boundary as well. So, for example, maybe I shouldn't do that. We might have zero cells that are zero manifolds, which are just points. Okay, I feel like this diagram is doomed to go wrong. Let's draw them like this. And so then our one cells can be some kind of one manifold, which have these things as their boundary. For example, that would be a perfectly good one. And then our two cells could be things that go from, say, that's a perfectly good one manifold with boundary. Here's another perfectly good one manifold with boundary. And so the natural thing to do to join them up is to have a two manifold that has that lot of stuff as some of its boundary and these corners. So, for example, a very typical one is this. So So this has now gone behind. And then you might want to have three cells, which are now extremely difficult to draw, which are things going from things like that. So you, sometimes people draw these as movies, where you have a series of things like this that show you how this thing transforms itself over kind of a period of time to another one. So the very fact that these things have become immediately difficult to draw is one of the things that alerts us to the fact that we need a better way of talking about these things. Perhaps an algebraic description of them. So now the idea is that these things should form an N category. Of course, when you think that something should form an N category, you'd better have a bit more evidence than just some hierarchy of cells. It's no use just having some zero things and some one things and some two things all the way up to N and declaring, oh, I think there's going to be an N category. So you expect that there ought to be various ways of composing these things as well, and probably K ways of composing the K cells. So when you're in a two category, you don't have any ways of composing zero cells. You have one way of composing one cells, and you have two different ways of composing two cells, because you can either compose them along their boundary zero cell, or you can compose them along their boundary one cell. So then with three cells, you expect to be able to compose them in three ways, along their boundary zero cell, one cell, or two cell. With K cells, should have K kinds of composition along bounding zero cells, one cells, two cells, and so on, all the way up to K minus one cells. So just to make sure we're clear about what this looks like, for three cells in some kind of N category, this going along the boundary two cells is the one that's the most obvious in a way. So here are a couple of one cells in which can live some two cells. And you can have some three cells going like this. So this composition is just the usual source target composition along their bounding two cells. If you had something like this, I'm going to run out of space now. So that's along bounding two cells. Along two cells. To do it along one cell, you've got a three cell up here, and you've got a three cell here, and you could compose those. And then to do it along zero cells, you'd have this configuration. And you'd have a three cell in here, and a three cell in here. So that gives the three different possible kinds of composition for three cells. So what about this thing? This is supposed to be a two cell, so there should be two different kinds of composition. And we can see the picture suggests to us that, for example, if we have, okay, here's our thing. We could do two things. We could stick another one on over here to the side, or we could stick another one underneath like this. So we could stick another one here that might look like this. Something or other. I'm not feeling very imaginative at the moment, so it's just going to be another one, I'm afraid. So when you stick those together, you'd get something that looks like... Well... Or you could stick something underneath. And that's a very different kind of composition. So in general, we're starting to see why, I mean, this is all very informal, but we're starting to see why we might expect K different kinds of things. Let me just quickly draw one. That, so you could take something else. And stick it on underneath. Okay, I'm feeling all right. And do what? Just put a little hole in the middle. There. Okay, very good. So if you stick those together, this will become something like... with a little hole in the middle. So the idea now is that an extended TQST should be the analogue of an ordinary TQST, except using these things with corners instead. And now, because we've got an N category here, we probably ought to have an N category here that can have enough structure to represent the stuff that we want over there. And this is why people have become interested in N vector spaces. So we're going to look for... something like an N functor from the N category, N cob, I'll give it a little star to show it's the ones with corners, to something, except of course, well, the whole thing should go in quotes because we don't know really what any of these things is yet, but this is the idea of where this stuff is supposed to be going. Some work has been done on what N vector spaces should be in dimension 2. There are various different pieces of work that have been done. There's some work by Byers and Krantz, and there's some work by Kapranov and Voivodsky, and Joseph L. Greta has started looking at representations using these two vector spaces. I'm not really going to talk about that for now, because I'm going to be more concerned with this side of it. So bearing all this motivation in mind, Byers and Dolan came up with a series of conjectures about how we should understand this N category. First of all, one conjecture about how we should understand it as an algebraic object, another as concerning how we should understand it as a kind of topological object, and then there's the stabilization hypothesis, which gives us the background for saying the things that we want to say in these conjectures. Three hypotheses Byers and Dolan. So the extended TQST hypothesis says basically this, that an n-dimensional extended TQST should be an N functor from this to that, where we're going to try and understand this object in some algebraic way. It should be some sort of naturally arising object. So the end result, I'm going to kind of do this backwards. So the extended GQFT hypothesis says the N category of which extended n-dimensional TQFTs are representations i.e. this N category over here. This is the thing of which, I mean, this is a representation of that. So we're saying that n-dimensional TQFTs are representations of this. What is this N category? Well, it is apparently supposed to be the free stable N category with duals on one object. Free stable N category with duals on one object. So far I haven't said anything about what a stable N category is. I haven't said anything about what duals are either, but this is supposed to motivate the whole point of this, which is to be interested in N categories with duals. So then there's the tangle hypothesis, which is about understanding these manifolds with corners in a sort of gradual way, gradually building up to the abstract manifold. So we can take some stepping stones by looking at these things embedded in some finite dimensional space instead. So these are what Byers and Dolan call tangles in a certain number of dimensions. So this hypothesis says the N category, let me get my index all right. Of framed, I'll explain these words in a minute. N tangles in N plus K dimensions So ignore the word framed for a second. An N tangle in N plus K dimensions is supposed to be an N manifold with corners like this embedded in N plus K dimensional space. It is equivalent in a suitable sense to the free weak K-tuply monoidal N category with duals. Weak K-tuply monoidal N category with duals on one object. Okay, so the framing thing is just to do with an orientation. So an N tangle in N plus K dimensions is an N manifold with corners embedded in N plus K dimensional space. And specifically, they're talking about embedding them all in N plus K dimensional cubes. So everything is going to be in a cube, which makes it easy to think about because then you can stack your cubes in any of the dimensions that your cubes have in N plus K cubes. That is the interval like this. And a framing is something that gives an orientation on this submanifold. It's really just, it's a trivialization of the normal bundle, which together with the standard orientation on here induces an orientation of the submanifold inside this cube. So if you don't feel like thinking of all that, you can just think of it as being an oriented submanifold of this cube where the orientation is has been given by that thing. So now, if we think about how manifolds embed in cubes, you can see how this might give rise to this situation, because if we're thinking about that as being abstract manifolds, we know something about how many dimensions you need in order to be able to embed a manifold in n plus k dimensions. So we know that an n manifold embeds in n plus k dimensions as long as k is greater than or equal to n plus 2. So this situation we expect to stabilize. And so the reason that this situation is a useful thing to study, although it seems like it's more specialized because we've embedded everything in cubes, if we embed them in high enough dimensional cubes, it ought to mimic the situation with abstract manifolds, because once you've embedded it in enough dimension, everything looks like an abstract manifold. No one's really made a formal definition of what a manifold with corners is in general dimensions, I think. Is that right? I think that's one of the most difficult things about it.
Well, it makes transparent the compositions that you want, like the categorical structure of it. But like, you could define stratified spaces, but I don't think...
There's a naive way to say something
Yeah, and then you have a portion of space. But formalizing that... Right, but does that give you... Yeah, right. Thanks. Okay, so this is, we know that every n manifold embeds in n plus k space if k is greater than or equal to n plus 2. So this situation in the case k greater than or equal to n plus 2 ought to give us this situation. So we've got some stabilization on the tangle side of the picture. So the thing that we need, the piece that we need to link up this hypothesis with this hypothesis, is some stabilization theorem on the algebraic side, that is, on the k-tuply monoidal n-category side. And that's what the last hypothesis is, which is the stabilization hypothesis. So I haven't said what a k-tuply monoidal n-category is, but that's what I'll do now. So informally, what's a k-tuply monoidal n-category is an n-category where you have given it some extra monoidal structures, not just one monoidal structure, but k different monoidal structures that somehow cohere with each other. And so the question is, how many more monoidal structures can you put in to an n-category before there isn't any more space to put in any more and they end up all having to be the same? So let's try and make that more precise. Is an n category with k coherent monoidal structures. So one way in which these arise is if you take an N category where all the bottom N dimensions are trivial. That is, there's only one zero cell, and there's only one one cell, and there's only one two cell, and so on up to a certain K. So these arise as I'll just say higher dimensional categories for a second. Higher dimensional categories which are trivial below dimension K. So if we've only got here's a sort of picture of what our category is going to look like. Here are the K-1 cells. Here are the K cells. Here are the K+1 cells. And so on. All the way down to, I'm going to go up to N+K cells. So if, supposing all of these dimensions have only one cell in them, so they're very trivial. Then we can perform a dimension shift and regard these K cells as the zero cells of a new N category. So these can be regarded as some zero cells of a new N category. So the K+1 cells become some one cells, and so on. And so the N+K cells become the N cells. So now we've got an N category, but it's not any old N category. It's a special kind of N category, because these zero cells used to be the K cells of an N+K category. And so they came equipped with K different forms of composition, not just nothing. I mean, usually you wouldn't expect anything on the zero cells of an N category. But because they are secretly K cells, they've actually got K forms of composition. Our composition usually comes with source and target matching conditions, but because all of these lower dimensional cells are the same, there aren't any source and target matching conditions, so this can be regarded as a kind of multiplication. So we've got K kinds of multiplication on here. Or monoidal structure, as we can call it. So that's what is meant by a K-tuply monoidal N category. So this is a K-tuply monoidal N category. And what it came from was a K times degenerate N+K category. So when you're over here, you think of it as a K degenerate N+K category. And when you regard it as an N category, it's a K-tuply monoidal N category. So one big question, which is interesting in its own right, is what kind of structures are these things? And this gives rise to what Bayes and Dolan called the periodic table of N categories. And some structures that we're very used to seeing appear, together with some structures we might be less used to seeing. But there are some very compelling patterns that appear as well. Although it's not very periodic, so it's not quite clear why it should be called a periodic table. that does organize itself into some nice rows and columns.
Do you mean the periodicity?
Right, so it's not really the periodicity of it that is its characterizing feature, but it's the fact that it helps you to predict things that you haven't discovered yet. Well, they all have to satisfy. One of the things that the N plus K category, all the compositions satisfied in the first place, was one some kind of interchange. But it's a weak interchange because it's a weak N plus K category. Not in general, no, but that's sort of the idea. So it's some kind of weak form of that. Yeah. So what we get. Right, that eventually. So eventually you expect all the multiplications to become the same. But in between the case where you expect them all to be the same and where they weren't all the same, there's some interesting structure that arises in between as follows. So let's see, if we put N up here, there's 0, right, and K is going to come down the side here. So when you have no monoidal structure at all, you just have a set, and then over here you have a category, and here you have a bi-category, and here you have a tri-category. When you've got one monoidal structure, that's just one kind of monoid structure, and what you're thinking about for here is a category that's only got one object. A category with only one object is a monoid. A bi-category with only one object is a monoidal category. And so here we expect to have a monoidal bi-category. Monoidal tri-category, which will be a one object tetra-category. Okay, so now if we do this again, and what we're looking at here is a two category with only one zero cell and only one cell. And it turns out that this is more or less the same as a commutative monoid. I'll say a little bit more about that later. So basically, it's exactly, I imagine, what Rick was saying, that there's an Ekman-Hilton argument that you use that shows that your two multiplication structures are commutative and the same, in fact. So now if you come down here, if you stick another monoidal structure onto a monoidal category, because everything's a bit weaker, you don't get to use an Ekman-Hilton argument to show that they're commutative and the same, but what you get is that they're sort of commutative up to isomorphism, and they're the same up to isomorphism. And a monoidal category where the monoid structure is commutative up to isomorphism is a braided monoidal category. So in a braided monoidal category, you have coherent isomorphisms from A tensor B to B tensor A, which are called the braidings. But they're just isomorphisms. There's nothing telling us that those are actually the same. And the same goes here. You have a braided monoidal bi-category and a braided monoidal tri-category, and so on. And so now some interesting things start happening, because if you try doing this again, you can't get any more stuff on a commutative monoid. If you try and add another multiplication that coheres with the others, all you're going to get is that it has to be the same and commutative by the same argument. So that's exactly the same thing as above. Here, what the next monoidal structure gives you is an axiom on your braiding, telling you that your braiding had to be, in fact, a symmetry. So What that means is that there are two things. There are two things you can do, right? You can go from A10 to B to B10 to A by your braiding, and if you want to go from B10 to A back again, you can either go by your braiding on B10 to A, or you can go by your braiding on A10 to B backwards. And those aren't necessarily the same thing, but in a symmetric monoidal category they are. And it turns out that putting another monoidal structure on here forces those to be equal. Sorry? Sorry. Thanks. And it's to do with the fact that we've run out of dimensions. At some point, you try and put more things in and you run out of dimensions and you hit the top and you have to have an axiom. So here, we're looking for something. Someone tell me what. But how many? Is this a four category? Is this a... It's a five category. It's a 3+2 category, thank you. It's a five category with lots of degeneracy at the bottom. And now we've got an extra dimension, so we've got some more room. We're not forced to be an axiom yet. What we get is another piece of structure, which is a bit weaker than a braiding, which is called, has been called a syllepsis. Who coined that term? Was it Ross? Yeah. So this is a syllectic, did I spell it right? Monoidal bicategory. And so you keep going and you call everything a syllepsis all the way along here. And after that stage, okay, now I suppose I could use another board.
One thing that's not so interesting is that in column two, we actually know what all those things are, not their appearance as degenerate higher category, but we can actually define what we need.
Yeah, so column two has been completely understood. So what happens at the next level is that there's no more space to move. So if you try and add another monoidal structure to your category, there isn't any more space and you just get the same thing, symmetric monoidal category again. At this point, your syllepsis can get one more stage stricter and turn into a symmetry. But that's the end of the road for it, and the next one is going to be the same. And over here, there's still something else. A something monoidal tricategory, and after that we'll get a symmetric monoidal tricategory. But that's the end of the road for this one, so it ends up the same here. So later on, I think that we should take a little break at some point, and after the break I'll talk about some different ways of moving around this periodic table that are quite interesting. The one that we've done so far is this one where we just took a degenerate. So it's in this direction where we take the one object case. And everything comes down in this direction. The thing that the stabilization hypothesis is concerned with is this one, where you gradually add in more monoidal structures. And in fact, part of our hypothesis is that this is supposed to be left adjoint to a forgetful functor. This forgetful functor, where you forget one of your monoidal structures. So here you've got supposedly two monoidal structures and you can forget one of them. So this F, the suspension, is supposed to be left adjoint to the forgetful functor. So we have a forgetful functor F from K-tuply monoidal N categories. This is for K-tuply monoidal N categories to k minus 1 to be monoidal n categories. So in terms of this diagram, we started with this entire n plus k category where everything was degenerate at the bottom. What this forgetful functor is doing is kind of ignoring these zero cells here and looking at it like this. So now it has become a k minus 1 degenerate n plus k minus 1 category. So because we've forgotten that that whole thing existed, what we've effectively done is forgotten one of the kinds of composition on the K cells. So over here in this world, we've still got the same number of non-trivial dimensions, that is, n non-trivial dimensions, but we've just forgotten one of the monoidal structures on here. So we've gone into a K minus 1 to the monoidal n category. So the stabilization hypothesis says that this has some kind of a left adjoint. When I say some kind of a, there's some issues here because these should be higher dimensional structures. So this should be some kind of weak higher dimensional functor. So perhaps this adjunction should be some kind of weak higher dimensional adjunction, which isn't something that we entirely understand at the moment.
So you understand it through monoidal categories and the category?
Yeah.
And not as the Ganese adjunction
then? Yeah, I think.
It's just like how monoids can be made into commutative monoids?
I think so.
I just don't know about it. Okay, that's the normal thing. Everybody knows about it?
Everybody knows about it.
Okay.
So S has some sort of weak higher dimensional. S hat, you can either read that as a or some sort of weak higher dimensional left adjoint. S for suspension. And there's a limit to the number of times you can do S and get anything different. So this says that S is some kind of an equivalent for K greater than or equal to N plus 2, which is the same indexing as we had the manifold stabilizing. So it's showing us that on the one hand, we've got this algebraic characterization, and on the other hand, we've got this manifold characterization, and we know that this side stabilizes. So this gives us the thought that we think that this side ought to stabilize at the same time. That is, at n k greater than or equal to n plus 2. S is an equivalent. So, see, hopefully that's the same indexing here. Okay, I think we should take a little break at this point. Are there any questions about that? I don't know, Andre? Where do you want to put the quasi categories?
If I may say something, one of the differences between topology is that in Kennedy theory there's notions of symmetric monoidal category and braided monoidal category, but there is not the notion of two braided monoidal category, which is the analog of what is called here the left. I mean, the braided monoidal category has something to do with configurations of points in the plane, right? Because braided is a braided one. difference from the pad, that pi 1 by E2, E3, you know, E2 spaces, E3 spaces, E2 spaces, the nerve of the breath of the rock ending by Serena Fiborovich, who is actually an E2 space. But in category 2, you don't have a notion of higher grading that, so that the nerve of such a higher object, like, would give, not very category 2, maybe higher category 2, E3 space, right? But with quasi categories, we do, for every n. So there's a notion of not only symmetric and grading,
Is the Dutkin nerve of a braided monadal 2 category E3 space, or does anyone know that? Take the nerve of a braided monoidal 2 category, so the Dutkin, I'm guessing that's the only nerve of a bi category I know. If you take that nerve, has anyone worked out if that...
Braided monoidal bi category?
Yeah.
That should be an E2 space.
E3 or E2?
E2.
Okay.
Because it's just braided monoidal. Everything which is braided monoidal is on a certain row, number 3.
Okay, yeah.
Right? The nerve of that should be E2 spaces, right?
Okay. So you're saying maybe celestic monoidal bicategory might be an E3 space, or?
Yeah, sure. At the third level, the nerve of that should be E3 spaces, right? So you can read things horizontally. E1 space, E2 space, E3 space. That's an E-infinity space.
Yeah, once you stabilize, you go to infinity.
Yeah, right. So what happens is that there is some kind of, it's like in the model, the usual stabilization.
Could it be improved?
Yes, sir?
What you were saying, if you take the
what has been proved is the result of Fyodorovich. I mean, Siegel had proved that the nerve of the symmetric monadal category is an E infinity space, sure. in this paper on commutative theory. And Fyodorovich, has proved that the nerve of the bread model category is in A2 space. Mm-hmm. But maybe, he has paper about K-tuffly monoidal categories, right?
But his ones are lax, I think.
Yeah.
He's doing them where.
Right, right.
So his situation doesn't stabilize because his things aren't invertible.
But his has a sort of algebraic object and the property that you take the nerve, you do get the E-K space. So what I said was a little bit confusing, you have to have k-fold, right? About this, a braided monoidal category should have two tensor products according to your description.
Yeah.
So why is it that it has only one?
Because they're... Well, this is something that I'll talk about after the break a little bit, but it's true that the two tensor products, in fact, there are more than two tensor products. There are 12 or something when you do. Are there 12 or 6? Maybe there are 12. But we just ignore the rest of them because they're all isomorphic to each other canonically, and so we sort of ignore them. I mean, this is something that I want to talk about next, which is how we should understand this periodic table and the sense in which those things really are the things that they say they are. So a braided monoidal category a priori only has one tensor product. When you get a braided monoidal category from this degenerate process, you get an awful lot more structure that you can sort of ignore canonically because they're all canonically isomorphic, but in fact you get something that has all these other tensor products as well. And it's, I think it's much more complicated than than people generally think. So I think we should have a couple of minutes break and then come back and talk about that. I don't really know if we're still, but oh, here we go. This stabilization should, may have reminded you of something from of may have reminded you of stable homotopy. So if you take a space and suspend it, then something interesting happens to all its homotopies. They all shift by one, and they keep shifting. And eventually, if you, for example, start with an n-dimensional CW complex, there's a limit to the number of times you can keep doing that and get something different. And that's very closely related to the stabilization hypothesis. So, for example, if you take a circle and you suspend it, so if it's got a base point here, and so you're identifying all these points like that, then any point here goes over here and turns into a loop, because it's got all its images up there and down here, and once you've hit the end, you've turned into a loop because all those parts have been identified. And if you take a path in here, then that's going to turn into a homotopy between the respective loops, like this, sort of going in between them like that. So this is to say that its homotopies all shift. So if you take x having homotopies like that, and you take the suspension of x, its zero-dimensional stuff becomes the one-dimensional stuff in the suspension. Then you can do it again, and it all shifts down another one. And it will shift down another one. And so if you take the fundamental n-groupoid of here, the relationship with this should be that what you get for the suspension is the suspension of the n-groupoid regarded as an n-category. So let's see if I can write that down. The pi n of the suspension should in some way be equivalent to the suspension of, am I doing this right? Is that right? Something like that. And then stabilization for homotopy should match up with the stabilization for our n categories as well. Oh, that doesn't go up, does it? Okay, so what about these? Yeah. Okay. Right. So let's have a look at how some of these things actually become the things they're supposed to be. So the usual Ekman-Hilton argument says that if you've got two multiplications on the same set, if they're both unital with the same unit and they satisfy some interchange, that is, one distributes over the other, then they must be commutative and in fact the same. Ekman-Hilton argument says, given two multiplications, let's call them multiplication 1 and multiplication 2 on a set, which are unital with the same unit, and distributive, that is, that A multiplied by B by the first one, multiplied by the second one by C multiplied by D, is the same as if you do it the other way around. A multiplied by C multiplied by B multiplied by D, then x1 and x2, as it were, are the same and commutative. And it's exactly the same as the proof that pi 2 of anything is abelian. You just take the diagrams that you would use to prove that pi 2 is abelian and interpret them algebraically. So the usual diagrams that you draw are something like this, and then you put in some identities, and then you do something like this, and then maybe you put in some identities the other way up, and then maybe you... Am I there yet? Yeah, probably. Right? So using these identities, they sort of moved around each other, and you can just write that down as a piece of algebra if you want to, where I've written one multiplication as this horizontal thing and the other multiplication as this vertical thing. You can also interpret this in a more too categorical way if you feel like it. We need some more space. So if we want to show that, if we want to consider a bicategory that has only one zero cell and only one one cell, we've got these two kinds of multiplication on its two cells. So we know it's going to be some kind of monoid, and it's got the objects of this monoid are going to be the two cells that remain. So we're going to look at a bicategory with only one zero cell, only one one cell, and some set of two cells, which are going to be the object of our monoid. And so we've got two kinds of multiplication on our object, because there's horizontal composition of the two cells and there's vertical composition of the two cells. So if we draw them out, here's a horizontal composition. And so all these one cells are the identity, right? Because there's only one one cell. So the other way around is like this. But there's also, over here, you could do the vertical composition. This way around, these are all the identities still. Or you could do the vertical composition the other way around. And now what we can do is we can use exactly that argument, except using pasting diagrams of two cells in a bicategory instead, to show that all these things are the same. So what we can do here is exactly what we do here and insert some identity two cells in here. So let's see if I can get this the right way around. This is the same as that, composed with that. If you can see that, maybe I should make it bigger. Because we know that A composed with the identity is just A, and that 1 composed with B is just B. And now we can perform interchange on it. So we've got A composed with 1 there, and B composed with 1 here. And now we can compose A with 1 to get A, and we can compose B with 1 to get B. Or can we? Wait.
Okay. Yeah, go on. Using the fact that vertical and horizontal composition in the two category are strict to be able to say that A is equal to A.
Right. So here's a very good observation. This is what we usually think of doing when we do this. But it actually takes some amount of work to show that this is the same as this. Because this is a bicategory, it's not a strict two category. So our units are only weakly unital. And when we do horizontal composition with a unit, we're only as strict as the one cell identity was in the first place. And in a bicategory, a one cell identity need not be strictly an identity. And so horizontal composition with a one cell need not be strictly an identity either. So in fact, it would be more honest to put a unit constraint in here. I don't know which one this is. I think it's the left one. Yeah.
Sometimes when I put it in a symmetric monoidal category, the best way to do that would be to go through this thing and then go, you can now construct the way to go from A, B, to B, A. And then you can go from B, A to A, B again, and then by coherence, are there any two ways of going between this?
Wait, we haven't got here yet. So there's a problem here. So what I'm trying to say is that I can draw up these things which we want to say, but there is in fact a problem right there. So let me try.
That's what I was pointing out.
Yeah? What are you pointing out? Keep going while I draw the rest of this.
You can go through this exercise and eventually you'll contract the units and everything, eventually you'll get back to the A.
Yep.
If you go through the same thing, the long 100-step process, you'll get to A, B.
Yeah.
But we know that any two ways of going between two points is because of coherence are the same. There's another way of going between A, B and A, B, and that's just the identity. So we've shown that the monoidal category is symmetric.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not a monoidal category at this point, it's just a monoid. So we've shown, that's how you show that it's commutative. I mean, there are lots of ways of interpreting this. So you can just sit down and go at it with your bare hands and show that that these two things are unital, that they satisfy the Ekman-Hilton things. But the reason that I want to draw this picture up is because when you want to try and look at it in the three-dimensional case, it's sort of helpful because this shows you how complicated it actually is. I think what you said is true. Okay. So it's only here, and by symmetry, it's also here, that's going to cause us a problem. And the reason is that, look, I've drawn something very bad, because this one composed with this one isn't even necessarily the same as this one. And so there's no way that you could even have a cell going from here to here because they have a different source and target. So the honest thing to do is to stick unit constraints everywhere on the top and on the bottom. And then you really do get to there. And that enables you to go all the way around. And so now we see something to do with what Andre was saying, that we have all these things are perfectly valid tensor products. And this is a unit constraint. So this is one composed with one, and there's a unit constraint which takes us from one composed with one to one, right, which is L or R or something. In fact, they're the same. You can also show that L... So there's a whole lot of extra stuff going on here that I haven't even talked about, which is very complicated because you have to prove that L on the unit equals R on the unit, because that shows that when you get in the middle here, you've got on one side an L and on one side an R, and that you can cancel them out with each other in the middle. But that's only true because Li equals Ri. So I'm not expecting you to follow all of this right now, but mostly what I want to do is emphasize that it's actually quite hard. And the fact that it's actually quite hard at this level isn't too much of a problem, but when you try and do it with tri-categories to get a braided monoidal category out, you have to keep track of all this data, and the fact that it was hard for bi-categories but sort of vanished means that for the tri-category level it's going to be hard, and it's just going to stay hard, and it's going to be there. And all of these things, so Nick and I like to call this the Ekman-Hilton clock because it looks like a clock, because there are 12 things going all the way around it, and 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock are really difficult to get in and out of, and everything else is sort of fine. But each of these is a perfectly good tensor product. And they're all isomorphic. And so that's why I said to Andre, in fact, there are 12 tensor products that arise completely naturally. And usually the one we decide we're going to use is this one, when we're taking a degenerate tri-category and we're going to try and form it into a braided monoidal category. But it's funny, because this one is the hardest one to get in and out of, because you've got this issue with the left and right unit. So what's going on here is that at this point you're using interchange just inside, and at this point you have to use left and right units. You have to get rid of your left and right units. And then here, you've got to put some left and right units back in again. And then you use interchange, and then you come back to here. So one of the morals of this story is that when you make a braided monoidal category out of a tri-category, it's this moving from, let's say, from this tensor product this way round to this tensor product the other way round, which is going to give us the braiding. So the braiding comes from all of this structure inside the tri-category. Now, usually people say the braiding in a braided monoidal category comes from interchange in the tri-category. This is a very popular thing to say. And it's true, it does come from interchange, but we have to be a bit careful because, look, it also comes from the left and right unit constraints. So one of the morals of this story is that even if you make your interchange strict, you can still get a weak braiding for a braided monoidal category when you come out of it. So the braiding, this is the braiding.
But if you took a
great category, it would just be interchanging. Right. So, given the tri-category, with only one zero cell and one cell, right, that's all. The braiding, we get a braided monoidal category in all sorts of different ways, because there are these 12 possible different, at least 12 different possible tensors. And the braiding comes from the weakness of both interchange and the unit. So we had lots of discussions last week about semi-strict N categories and the fact that every tri-category is tri-equivalent to a gray category, which is a tri-category in which interchange is weak but everything else is strict. Now, because interchange is weak, you still get a braiding out in the degenerate case. But there's another thing you could do, and Joachim Kopp and Andre have done some work on what happens if you keep the units weak but make everything else strict. And so, at first sight, it looks like that's not going to give you a braided monoidal category, until you remember that the braiding comes from the weakness of the units as well. So you can make interchange strict and just have your units weak, and that will still give you a braiding. And this is important because, I'm getting a bit off topic now, but we know that we need to be able to do a braiding in order to get the full weakness for N categories. And if we look at modeling homotopy 3 types, we know that if we take everything to be strict, it's too strict, because you don't get the thing that corresponds to a braiding in your 3 groupoids. But usually we say, oh, well, it's okay, because if you keep interchange weak, you're going to get a braiding. But if you actually look at where interchange comes in a fundamental N groupoid, and we'll look at this on Thursday when we do Trimble's definition of N category. In fact, interchange is naturally strict in general when you're doing fundamental N groupoids. And this is something that that confuses people because they think, oh, but no, you can't model homotopy three types using strict three groupoids where interchange is strict. But it actually, everything interesting comes out of the units, and it can be a sort of slogan that to remember for all this stuff, because it's an important one for us to remember because we're interested in these n categories where everything is trivial below a certain dimension, that all sorts of trouble arises when you look at maps between identities. All sorts of interesting things, I should say. All sorts of interesting structure arises when we allow non-trivial morphisms between identity cells. All right, it's 5 o'clock, so I should stop at this point. Are there any questions about this? Yep. Oh, I didn't really tell you which direction I was thinking of as which. So, I think it could have been either, couldn't it?
Or if you're composing along a 0 cell and composing along a 1 cell and switching.
Right, but I think
side, you're composing along 0 cells because you're gluing the point to one top of the point to this one. Whereas when you stuck it on top like this, you're gluing along a 1 cell.
Right, but I could have considered the entire thing the other way up, couldn't I? Oh no, not with the one I drew.
I think they definitely mean something different, each of them.
Right, but a lot of them can be considered both way up. If I haven't told you which way up I'm considering them, then they could be a lot. But probably the one I drew. I think the one I drew was unambiguous.
Yeah, so you're catching it along 0 cells.
So, I think that. So, this is a 0 cell, and that's another 0 cell. So this is a 1 cell, right? And so here's the same 0 cell that's there, and here's the same 0 cell that's there, and that was a 2 cell like this. Whoops. So this is a 2 cell. So in that case, when I stuck one along that way, that was horizontal composition because it was composed along these. So you have to, there's some question, I think perhaps you're asking about the question of what these things are. Are you?
Kind of like you're turning your bicategory into a double category where all vertical arrows
are. Yeah. So this thing, so we'll talk about this more tomorrow when we start putting everything in boxes and composing them. But it's looking a bit cubical. That is to say, this cell, I mean, it just has a sort of cubical shape to it. And so it looks like there ought to be some source target matching thing going along here. But in fact, in all the things we look at, this thing is forced to be the identity coming along the bottom. And so that's why it has effectively become a globular cell like this. Because these things are all identities. So as long as your next cell along has the same 0 cell here, then it's going to have the same vertical thing because this is forced to be the identity coming alongside. Did that answer your question? Okay. Any more questions? Aaron, you were about to ask a question.
No, I was just going to ask everyone. I was wondering, well, I missed that story. Is a 3-2-3 degenerate tri-category, does it have more distinguished objects?
Yeah. I haven't even mentioned that. So that's a whole another kettle of fish. But in fact, when you do this, you don't just get a commutative monoid when you take a doubly degenerate bicategory, because you have all these coherence constraints floating around. So you have some extra structure in your bicategory. You don't just have a set of two cells. Some of your two cells have been distinguished because they are left and right unit constraints and associativity constraints. So in fact, when you make it into a commutative monoid, you've got these extra distinguished cells floating around that don't really do anything. They just are there because you chose them as part of your structure for your bicategory. So when you come over here, you have to be a bit careful. I mean, this is the subject of a whole different paper that Nick and I wrote. It's not just a commutative monoid. It's a commutative monoid equipped with some random distinguished invertible elements that sort of don't exactly get in the way, but maybe they do. I mean, you have to be very careful what you mean, because if you wanted to say something like, the category of doubly degenerate bicategories is equivalent to the category of commutative monoids or something, then you start running into problems because these extra chosen cells pop up. And if you're not very careful about it, you don't get equivalences in the places you want them to be. So as you come further down here, it gets worse and worse, because when you have a triply degenerate tricategory, you have all that extra coherence constraint that Nick told us about the other day. You have, you know, four things for the associator and four things for the left and right units maybe, and then another eight of these. So you'll get even more distinguished invertible elements, and then here you'll get even more distinguished invertible elements, and as you keep going down here, we conjecture that you'll just get more and more and more distinguished invertible elements. So that's probably not a very serious impediment to the stabilization hypothesis. It just means that you have to state your stabilization hypothesis very carefully.
Yeah, if you didn't use algebraic
N-categories. If you didn't use algebraic N-categories, then the whole problem would go away because you wouldn't have chosen all those constraints. Yeah,
yeah, sorry, it was a bit off topic. I was just kind of curious when you were drawing the
kids. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so we figured out that here you have, at 2 you have one distinguished invertible element, and here you have 8 or 11 or something. And so it seems like it will just get more and more very quickly as you go along.
And there's no theorem like the fact that L1 equals R1, that's like higher analogs of those?
So yeah, so they're all higher analogs, so some of them cancel out.
Okay.
So you start off with, you know, 23 coherence constraints or something, and then some of them turn out to be completely determined by the others. So you only end up with 8 or something. We're going to write that paper this week. Are you stretching me? Are there any other questions?